Jennifer Doliak, thank you for talking to Reason.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so I know probably everyone asks you this question, but I'm going to start with the low-hanging fruit, and it's also what your book begins with. I find it fundamentally interesting that you are an economist who primarily talks about crime and criminal justice. So just starting off there, I would be interested to hear you talk a little more about the relationship between those two things, because I think a lot of people would think they're unrelated, and how you got them.
Yeah. So yeah, economists study all kinds of things that are not GDP and money and banks. And so that tends to be surprising to everyone. But you know, we study their education economists, health economists, and their crime economists. I think there are three big reasons that that economics is useful for thinking about crime. One is we think a lot about how people respond to incentives. So that's really the theoretical lens that economists bring to the table. And it turns out there are misaligned incentives throughout the criminal justice system. And so that lens and that thinking about, you know, if we want to change behavior, we should be changing the costs and benefits that people are responding to. That is just a different lens than lawyers bring or sociologists bring to the conversation. The second is that economists are more obsessed than everyone else with distinguishing correlation from causation. And so if we want to know if a policy or program actually works and you know, if we want to measure exactly what the impact of some intervention is on behavior, economists tend to be the best people to talk to about that. And then the third is that because we're so good at measuring those impacts, we can be really helpful to policymakers and practitioners who want to think about how to allocate their scarce resources to meet some goal. And so we love doing those cost-benefit analyses and helping to think through, you know, how should you spend your next dollar on more police or more prisons or more healthcare, right? And so how I got here, I mean, I went and got a PhD, and because I was really interested in making policy better. I was an economics major in college, love the economics toolkit, that all of those things really appealed to me. And then I was, you know, 23 years old in DC and loved policy and loved politics and looked around at some point and realized everyone with a job that seemed really cool to me had a PhD in economics. And so I really needed to go do that. And when I went to grad school, I think I really expected I would study education because that was, you know, the only industry I really knew at that point. You know, the way an econ PhD works is at some point you have to hunt around for natural experiments that you can apply this toolkit to. Real world policy changes or practice that we can use our empirical toolkit to measure causal effects of some policy or program. And I wound up reading a newspaper article about law enforcement DNA databases. And the article was describing that, you know, in the United States, every state has its own laws about which categories of people convicted of or arrested for different crimes, you know, which groups of those offenders are required to provide a DNA sample to the database. And the point of the article was, isn't this, you know, this is so ridiculous that the policies vary so much and it seems so ad hoc that you can be convicted of the same crime in different states and have different outcomes here. But to someone like me, that's great for research. That's the perfect natural experiment. So my dissertation wound up being on the impacts of DNA databases. And here I am many, many years later, still thinking about this topic.
This is going, maybe might sound like a weird question, but do you at all think of our criminal justice system as a marketplace of sorts? Is that a silly thing to ask?
No, it's not a silly thing to ask.
I'm fascinated by that. The idea you talk about incentives and markets, of applying that to something that is often called, you know, the monopoly on force, that sort of thing. So I would be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, you're right that the government has this monopoly on force, and so that that's the reason government is involved in this this space at all. Like, you could imagine a world where just the private markets provided safety, right? But that provision of safety, those individual choices have important externalities on the rest of us, and so there's a really strong reason for government to play a role here. And yeah, but so I think, you know, there, you know, economists will say things like there's a market for crime, even that, you know, if you if someone stops, you take someone off the street who is breaking into houses, then there might be an opportunity and new people might come in to break into those houses. And so we do think a lot about, you know, how people respond to those incentives and those opportunities. And now I work at Arnold Ventures, which is a philanthropy that focuses on these issues. And my team is thinking a lot about, you know, how can we help the different actors, whether it's private prisons or the different vendors working in this space or nonprofits that are providing different services but getting government funding, how can we make sure that we are in our contracts providing, you know, paying people based on what outcomes we actually want to see rather than just beds filled, say. You know, there are all of these different ways that we, you know, everyone's responding to incentives all the time, and we can use that to our advantage. You know, I think the lens, again, that I bring as an economist to this conversation is just so different than the lens that other social scientists and lawyers bring, in that I do think of the private market and market forces as being a tremendous force that we can use for good. And if we can harness those forces to align incentives, then it makes quick work of solving a lot of problems that otherwise are really difficult to solve.
So your book is called The Science of Second Chances. And I feel like second chances were like really in like 10 years ago. In a bipartisan way, or this is a libertarian magazine, so I say tripartisan. In a way that united people, that Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Green Party, well, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was something that a lot of people could come together on. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be the case to me anymore. You know, I thought it was interesting during the presidential primary, Ron DeSantis labeled the First Step Act, which was widely seen as a something everyone could celebrate, the recidivism rates, very successful, as a jailbreak bill. I'm wondering how you think about that when talking about second chances. Do you get a lot of pushback now on a topic that I think used to be kind of uncontroversial and seems to have been radioactive over the course of just a few years? So another way to say it is, can you respond to someone who's very skeptical that that's even something we should care about?
I think you're right that there was a, you know, in the mid 2010s or so, we were in the midst of a big movement where you did have this, you know, strange bedfellows all coming together. Everyone wanted to talk about second chances, and you had, you know, the left there because they're concerned about social justice and racial disparities, and you have the religious right there because they think about you know, the power of just redemption and wanting people to be able to forgiveness. And then you have the libertarians there who are saying criminal justice system is a big failed government program, right? We should be doing less, you know, lock people up less. And I think, you know, that movement did so much good and accomplished so much good, and also in some ways went too far, right? I think what wound up happening was that there was so much conversation and consciousness raising about the harms of the system, which were important, and an important piece of the conversation that had not been really highlighted before. And so that was really the reason to bring that up. It was also at a time when crime rates were extremely low, right? And had been falling for a very long time. And so I think everyone was like, okay, we solved this crime thing. Now, can we talk about the unintended consequences and the harms that, you know, maybe over-enforcement can have? And then we got to COVID and we saw homicide rates go up and shootings go up. And everyone suddenly was like, maybe we haven't solved this crime thing. Public safety actually really matters. And I think, frankly, folks, especially on the far left, lost sight of public safety as the primary goal here. Like, that's the reason we're doing all of this, right? Is that crime is really costly to communities. And so, I mean, I do think we're seeing pushback in many ways on even the label criminal justice reform. You know, I mean, we have events now where I'm focused on criminal justice reform necessarily. I'm focused on public safety. And I think part of that is because it's become a left-coded term to say you want to have reform of the system, even though everyone who's working on this topic and who cares about public safety is fundamentally trying to reform things. So I do think that, you know, we're course correcting a bit. The pendulum swung too far. It's swinging back. I think my interest is in making sure it doesn't swing back too far the other way. And the reality is that what matters here is both the harms of the system matter, but the harms of crime also matter. And we can talk about both of those things, and both of those things should be part of our calculus and our policymaking. And you're right. Sometimes when I'm talking about, I have a piece in the book, especially about research saying we should be erring toward leniency for first-time defendants. So your first misdemeanor charge, your first felony charge, it turns out the data shows the best thing to do in that case is, you know, bring you to court, but then like putting a criminal record on your record at that point actually does more harm than good. And we could just dismiss the case or put you on probation period and drop the charges later. And that's more helpful. And people's response will be, but what about the person who cycled through 17 times? They've already had 17 chances. They don't deserve any more. And my response to that is generally, that's not a first-time defendant, right? And you know, we need different. Right. It's clearly that's not working. If they've gone through 17 times, what we're doing is not working. We need something different for them. But I guess I don't hear the pushback on just the concept of second chances. I think we all see in our lives in general, people deserve, like, we all make mistakes in all kinds of ways. They're not necessarily criminal mistakes, but we all make mistakes and want to feel like we would have a chance to try something else. I think the question is more, do we all deserve 17th chances? That becomes the conversation a bit more that I hear on cable news, at least.
Do we?
I think one takeaway, I have two parts to this answer. One is, as an economist, I struggle a lot with giving people prescriptions on like what people deserve or what they should do. Right. My inclination in all of my training is to say, what are your goals? How can we meet them? And so the question in my mind is, okay, if we want to improve public safety, what do we do for that person after their 17th time going through the system? And of course, it depends on what they're in the system for, right? If it's just trespassing charges and there's clearly untreated mental illness, we clearly, and cities across the country, are trying to figure out what do we do for that population, especially if they are refusing to engage in treatment. They're not doing it voluntarily. You know, where's a line where we could mandate treatment for people? If they're going through the system for violent crime, then they should probably be, you know, if they're an active public safety threat, it's a different conversation. They should probably be locked up. But I think, you know, one big takeaway for me from the research literature and that I hope comes through in the book is that there is a lot we can do to intervene at each stage of the process. And regardless of it, you know, what point it is in someone's life, where we can put people on a better path. You know, interventions don't work for everyone. There are, of course, going to be some people where the best thing we can do is just lock them up forever. But I really think that those people are exceptions that prove the rule, that, you know, most people are going to get out of prison. Most people are cycling through the system for... Yeah, it's just a huge number. I mean, most people cycling through the system, it's for nonviolent stuff. So we're not going to lock them up forever. And then the entire game is, how can we make the best use of the intervention points we have when they are in court, when they're in prison, when they're on probation? You know, the worst case scenario in my mind is really, it's just pure, we're locking people up, keeping them off the street. It's just a holding pen. That's a really expensive intervention if that's the best we can do. And I think we should all be trying harder to figure out, how can we use that time that we have people to actively put them on a better path and help them, help all of us.
Hey, recent interview listeners, do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connections Seminar in Chicago from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme, Reason and Love, explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Alexis de Tocqueville in small, dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't sit through lectures. They practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students explore Chicago's cultural landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, including room for the full week, with scholarships available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason.
You mentioned that you feel kind of fundamentally at odds with some of the people on kind of the farther left, maybe the farthest left. I assume you're talking about kind of like the burn it all down, abolish everything movement that commanded a lot of airtime around 2020, 2021. Mm-hmm. You might hate this question, but I'm curious. If you had to concede one point to them, could you, and what would it be?
They are definitely right that the best and cheapest way to reduce public safety or to reduce crime rates and improve public safety is to intervene earlier and prevent people from ever being engaged in the system. So the more that we can engage, we can, you know, invest in young kids or teens, and whether it's through public benefits, food stamps. Turns out, like, food stamps for young children are a really great way to prevent future crime, right? They're less likely to grow up and be engaged in the system. So I think the far left is totally right that, you know, poverty matters. Poverty is a driver of crime. And then investing in social services and doing more on the prevention side is really effective and really cost effective. Where I disagree with them is I don't think that's the whole game. Like, I think there will always be a role for a criminal justice system, for police and prisons. Even Norway has police and prisons, right? We're always going to need, these are going to be complements. It's not one or the other.
Your book is also fundamentally about giving the system a second chance, which I think is interesting, that both defendants and the government, the idea that both defendants and the government may deserve second chances. Why does the system deserve a second chance?
Hmm. I mean, frankly, it's just because we have to figure this out. It's kind of out of necessity, right? Like, the public safety really matters. Crime is really costly to communities. Government is, for better or worse, the best actor we have to provide that service. And so, you know, whether we like it or not, we have to give the system a second chance here. We have to build a system that is effective at providing the public safety that we all want. I think, you know, as you said earlier, there's a lot of airtime given to this argument that, you know, we just abolish police and prisons, burn it all down. We're not going to do that. We're not going to burn it all down. Right. These institutions are here to stay. And so if you care about putting people on a better path, if you care about making the best use of these resources and helping communities as much as possible, you should have a seat at the table and be part of the conversation and not just, you know, pretend that it's an option to just close all the prisons down.
Let's get into specifics. What are we doing right now that really does not work?
So the biggest thing is using long sentences in the hopes that will deter and prevent future crime. So this is the way that, you know, I'm an economist. I believe in incentives. There is this core idea that if you want to deter people from committing crime in the future, the way, you know, people are weighing costs and benefits, you want to increase the costs. You could reduce the benefits of committing crime. That can be hard. Or you can increase the cost of committing crime. And that can come through either the probability that you face consequences or the severity of those consequences, the length of the sentence in most cases. And so, especially in the United States over the past many decades, we have really focused our attention on that second piece, the increasing the length of sentence. And in part because, you know, that's the intuition. It feels like it should work.
Right. And we're talking part about like mandatory minimums, that kind of thing.
Mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines, just sentence enhancements. Right. I think even, you know, from the 1990s through today, it's incredibly common to see legislatures that are, you know, especially at the state level, that where most of the criminal justice policies made, when they're worried about crime in the state, they just make sentences longer, you know, and in some ways that's just, it makes sense because it's relatively straightforward for a legislature to do. As you can just change the law and change the sentencing guidelines and say, if you do something terrible, but you also have a gun, then you have this, you know, that's an aggravating factor and you get extra years on your prison sentence. And so in some ways it's straightforward, but in some ways it's also just philosophical. It feels like, you know, this should deter crime. And it just turns out it doesn't. It turns out that most people who are on the margin of committing crime, who are at risk, who we're trying to deter, simply aren't thinking that far ahead. And so adding years to a sentence when they're not thinking past this week, maybe if we're lucky this month, it's just not entering their calculus if the sentence is 1 year versus 2 years versus 5 years, much less 20 years.
Right.
And then at the same time, we also know, because, you know, the natural response could be, well, you know, maybe we can't deter anybody. And so we just lock people up and, you know, someone's a public safety threat. We keep them off the streets. That is true. And that's the valuable role that jail and prison play. But again, there are diminishing returns here, right? So we have people who are committing crime typically age out of that really quickly. So crime tends to be a young man's game. People do a lot of dumb, reckless, impulsive stuff when they're young until their brain fully develops in their mid-20s. And so, you know, locking someone up for something they do when they're 20 years old until they're 60 just doesn't, we are probably preventing a bunch of crime when they're in their 20s. But once they're in their 30s, 40s, 50s, they're not an active public safety threat anymore in most cases. And so then we're not paying for any public safety. So this is all to say this emphasis on long sentences was a great idea, but we've tried it for a while. We have lots of evidence that is not having the public safety impact that we thought it would. What matters much more is the probability of any consequences. So it's the swiftness and certainty of consequences.
No one and so that for any amount of time.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, there are going to be some exceptions. Some people should be in prison for longer, but for the vast majority of people, it's really just any consequences, and it doesn't matter as much what the consequences are. And so this means that we should be investing our time and resources in solving more crimes faster, right? So increasing clearance rates across the country, which tend to be much lower than most people think.
Right. Two questions. How do you respond to someone then? You mentioned, like, I mean, this is obviously just a theoretical, the guy who is in prison from 20 to 60, a 4-year sentence, I'm assuming, you know, in this hypothetical, a serious crime that had a victim or victims.
Yep.
How do you respond to someone who says, well, actually, this isn't about preventing crime. This is a moral argument. You know, I think because second chances, it's interesting. The idea of a second chance, I think, is often viewed as a moral argument. You know, I grew up in an evangelical Christian community, for example. Mm-hmm. So that is very important to that community. But you're making more of a scientific argument, right? And so what would you say to someone who was like, it doesn't matter about deterrence. It doesn't matter. This is about justice.
Yeah. So I actually find it very helpful when I'm talking to policymakers in particular to back up and say, okay, why do we put people in prison? I think there are at least four reasons. One is deterrence, which I just talked about. One is incapacitation. So that's the idea that you take someone who's an active public safety threat off the street, you physically incapacitate them so they can't commit crime in the community anymore. The third is rehabilitation, at least in theory, and some places are better at doing this than others. This is an intervention point. We have them locked up. They can participate in programs. They can take education classes. They can engage in therapy. You know, we can put the actively try to put them on a better path when they leave. And then the fourth is retribution, and so that's what you're talking about, is sort of like, what does someone deserve? Someone did something bad. They just deserve to suffer for it for a while, and I, as an economist, have a lot to say about the first three. The first three are a matter of public safety.
Right.
What are we actually getting? If we have an intervention, we can look at data and figure out what is the impact on future behavior, on crime rates.
And the bang
that fourth retribution, bang for the buck. Exactly. But that fourth, how much retribution, or on the flip side, how much mercy someone deserves, I have nothing to say about that as an economist. I have my own personal preferences like everybody else, but they're not, you know, that's not why I'm here. That's not why anyone would listen to me. And so it's very clear to me, like, that's not my lane. But it is also, I think, really useful to name that, because it is typically the elephant in the room. It's like, I think this desire for retribution is what drives a lot of our public conversation. But we typically have the conversation in a way that kind of conflates all of these things. We're saying we're doing it for public safety, but it's actually for retribution. And so I find it very useful to just say, whatever your preferences are about retribution, if you think someone just deserves to be in prison for a long time because they did something so terrible, that is totally fine. And you are entitled to your beliefs and moral judgment about that. But if you want less crime for less money, I can help you do that. Right. And presumably most people want both of those things to some extent.
Right. You also mentioned clearance rates, which has been something that has fascinated me for a very long time. Obviously correct, that they are far lower than a lot of people would admit. You have basically a 50-50 chance in this country of getting away with murder, which is blows my mind.
Crazy,
crimes, are almost just not even really on the map. It's like something, I don't want to say the wrong number, but I want to say it's like
10%.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. The vast majority, my car got broken into in Dallas and police sent me a little postcard that was like, thank you so much, or sorry for your trouble, but we can't do anything for you. I was like, okay.
Right. The 10% is for felony property. Right,
exactly.
Crime.
If you are like me and they left my cigarette, there are cigarettes in my car, actually, I don't even smoke. I tell the story every time clearance rates come up because I do think it's a good, it was a personal like a call for me. It was like, police really just don't have the time and or money to focus on these things. Can you talk a little bit about, in your research, why clearance rates are so low? And is there something we can do to fix it?
I think the reason they're so low, honestly, is because we just haven't really emphasized this. We've been so focused on the way to prevent and deter crime is longer sentences. And then at the same time, there was a ton of research showing that hiring more police, putting more police on the streets does reduce crime.
Right, because people when they walk by police, they don't want to, like you said, they don't want that 5-year sentence or 10, they're afraid of getting in trouble. Police equal trouble.
Right. You're not going to steal a car or break into someone's car right in front of a cop, right? Because and the idea there is you're going to get caught, right? I mean, there's just like that much higher certainty of consequences, whatever the consequences are. And so you're not going to do it. And so we have all this evidence that police have this deterrent effect on crime. I think it's also interesting that all that evidence is you don't see necessarily arrest rates go up. So it's not coming through that incapacitation channel. It really is that deterrent channel, just having them around. People behave when they see a cop. and so we know that, but beyond just having police around and on patrol, we haven't really invested in the investigation side. When a crime does happen, how do we solve the crimes faster? That really hasn't been the emphasis. And so to just give you an example, it turns out that most detectives in this country don't really get any training. You get promoted to be a detective in a police department based on seniority or because you seem to have you got good interpersonal skills or something. And so we'll promote you.
We all think of detectives as the real ones. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the one in the movies. That's it's kind of glamorous. You know what I mean? I think of it like that, but you're saying they don't receive a lot of institutional support to actually accomplish what they're supposed to be doing.
Right. And so one thing we're working with an organization called PERF, the Police Executive Research Forum, to just what if we actually developed a training curriculum for detectives? Could we just have a school for detectives? And so they're working on that. And so far, my sense is everyone they're talking to is oh my gosh, we've needed this for so long. I'm so glad you're doing this. And we're going to roll it out as a randomized trial, of course. So we'll know what the impact is. But so we can do stuff like that. I was just in Utah this week. The governor just signed a bill that is going to create a fund for law enforcement, in many ways modeled off of federal COPS grants, which provide resources to police departments to hire more cops, which is how we have all this research evidence on the hiring more police officers. But so this fund that Utah passed and is funded, other states are considering similar bills, would provide resources to law enforcement specifically targeted at solving more crimes. So they could use the money to hire more detectives. They could use the money for DNA analysis. They could use the money for trying out some other interesting tools. Drones as first responders have become very interesting and popular among police departments. AI is going to create so many more opportunities for new technology that, you know, if we deploy correctly and responsibly, could do a lot of good. But we just need to honestly just be out there trying stuff and figure out what works, do it in a way we can learn from it so that, you know, we have lots of different police departments trying different ways of solving more crimes, see what actually moves the needle here so that we can scale those. But yeah, you're right. I mean, most people just have no idea that clearance rates are so low. And then they become very frustrated that police don't respond when their bike is stolen or something. It's just not a priority. Right. But we can change that.
I think the idea of like just kind of throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks is very underrated in stuff like this.
Yes.
It feels like people are very afraid to try things, right? And that there are, you know, red tapey barriers to doing so. Before we move on from what really doesn't work, you talked a bit about length of sentences. Mm-hmm. Is there like a magic formula, like your magic econ formula to be like, this is the right length? Or is it one of those things that we just said of like, you just kind of have to try different increments and see kind of when the risks outweigh the benefits and vice versa?
Yeah. Yeah. We don't know. There's no magic number. There's no like optimal sentence. We would, maybe one day we'll get there, but you're right. We would have to just be trying lots of different things and see what has an impact on crime on the ground.
I would love to hear about some findings that really shocked you and your priors that you went into. You were like, this definitely works. Oh no, it doesn't. Or this definitely doesn't work. Oh, it does.
Yeah. I think the research that has changed my mind the most is what I alluded to earlier about erring toward leniency for first-time defendants. So this has been a really hot political, you know, argument between progressive prosecutors and the more tough on crime crowd.
So you went into that thinking that was not something that...
Yeah, I thought, so what we were looking at specifically in that research was the decision by a prosecutor in the very first court hearing, the arraignment hearing, like, do we move this case forward or not? And the progressive prosecutors would say, you should definitely drop the case, especially for these low-level crimes. These were nonviolent misdemeanors. This is trespassing, public drinking, shoplifting. So these really minor offenses. Those on the far left have been arguing, you know, convicting people of these crimes just pulls them into the criminal justice system and makes things worse. It increases crime rather than reducing it. And yeah, my prior on that was that was probably overstated, that this was probably didn't really matter much. Or if anything, I was expecting to see in the research that, you know, dropping a case in that first hearing would increase crime a bit. The question in my mind was just how much and was it worth it, right? Like, you know, there's some cost to the system to moving all these cases forward. Of course, they're overwhelmed. Like, how much crime are we talking about here? What's the trade-off? And then that research, and just to give you a sense of, you know, how we would do this, you've got cases that are essentially randomly assigned to different prosecutors, and some are harsher and some are more lenient. And so some defendants get lucky and they get a more lenient prosecutor, and so their case is dropped. Whereas if they'd gotten unlucky and gotten a different prosecutor, their case would have moved forward. So that's the natural experiment we were able to use. And what we found was that if you got lucky and had the lenient prosecutor and your case is dropped, you're about 50% less likely to come back with new charges, 50% less likely to come back with new charges. So it's just, not only were there no trade-offs, it was just a massive reduction in future criminal behavior for dropping those charges and not putting, you know, this criminal charge on someone's record. Because even a charge, once you're arraigned in many places, you have that charges on your record that employers can see going forward, even if, you know, you're not convicted in the future. And so having that first criminal record And as I said earlier, like this is all about first-time defendants. And we can look at like different effects by different, like where you are in the system. The vast majority of this effect really came from, this was your first misdemeanor charge. And if we put that charge on your record, then you're much more likely to come back with a new crime in the future. So that evidence really changed my mind about this errant or leniency idea. I love it when research changes my mind.
And then was there anything that, actually I'll say it like this. I feel like this conversation is very difficult because criminal justice systems vary so drastically by location and geography. Sure. Mm-hmm. I think most people, or maybe not most people, I won't make such a broad claim, but I think a lot of people are under the impression that, the majority maybe of first-time offenders for small things like that get their cases dismissed. Is that not the case? Mm-hmm. And are there places in the country where if you get a first-time offense for something that's not like a shocking crime, that you will suffer for it?
Yeah. You're right. It does vary place to place and different prosecutors.
Right. And the progressive areas you're referring to kind of get a lot of the spotlight. So we hear about them the most.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in this particular case, so the study we were doing was in Suffolk County, Massachusetts, where Boston's located. It had one of these more progressive prosecutors at the helm, that she was the one who gave us the data, which we're very grateful for. And so we were also able to look at, she came in and had a implemented a presumption of non-prosecution for this list of nonviolent misdemeanors. And so we're able to see even just like, what was the shift, right? And it went from something like, I don't know, the previous much more conservative DA was dropping something like 40% of the cases, and she was dropping closer to 60% of the cases. And so even there, it's like, there a lot of... Every court is, again, so overwhelmed. This is the job of the prosecutor's office to figure out, of the charges that are coming to them, which ones are worth the court's time and the state's time to prosecute. And so there are always cases that are being dropped. It's just kind of, it's a matter of degree. And so even in those cases, you do have some first-time defendants that are prosecuted, even in the most liberal offices, and you do have some first-time defendants whose cases are dropped in the most conservative offices. It's really just a matter of what share of them. I think the question is more about, is we've tended to focus much more on the sentence, the consequences, and less on the probability of consequence, or even how much that conviction and that criminal record matters. And so I think one of the things that's coming out of the research, this study and other studies that have been emerging over the last couple of years, that's been really fascinating to me, is being able to really distinguish between the impact of a criminal record and the impact of the sentence. And, one reason most people have been really, especially on the left, have been focused on reducing mass incarceration is this concern that being incarcerated for a long time really makes you much worse off. Being in prison really makes you much worse off. Makes it hard to find a job and everything else. And the studies that are coming out are showing that prison sentence actually is not doing anything. It's all the criminal record. And so if you have, and they're using these natural experiments where some judges, you get a criminal record and you're just on probation or something, and some you go to prison, and it doesn't matter if you're in prison. Once you've got that criminal record, your trajectory has changed. And so that has really big implications for how we think about what's the punishment. and so in these cases where even in these more progressive offices, they might, try to strike plea bargains. They might, which means you're going to be convicted in some way, but just really reducing, minimizing the sentence. And so even in those cases, there are a lot of people who wind up with the charge on their record, wind up with a conviction on their record, but they might get off easier in terms of how much time they would spend on probation. So the point of this research is we should be focusing more on the conviction decision or the charge decision in the first place.
Speaking of employment, a lot of your research has focused on, they're called ban the box policies. The idea that an employer perhaps should not even be permitted under law to consider an employee, a prospective employee's record. Can you talk about what you have found about those policies?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ban the box policies were in many ways, like there's the Ban the Box policy and there's the Ban the Box movement that is really part of the Second Chance movement that we were talking about before. And I think that Ban the Box movement did a lot of good in terms of like raising awareness and so on. The Ban the Box policy specifically that movement was part of what the movement was pushing for, would remove the box that was typically on most job applications where it says like, check this box if you have a felony conviction, right? Or if you have a criminal record at all. And anecdotally, a lot of employers just discard your application as soon as they see that box checked. And so, you know, that's really unfair to people who are coming out of prison, who would be a great employee. They don't get a chance to
society.
They've paid their debt and have maybe really invested in themselves. They've taken lots of classes. They've gone through therapy. They've really worked on themselves. They've grown up. And now they really would be a great employee. But employers are now grouping them in with everyone who has a criminal record, many of whom might not be great employees. So, you know, again, this is where I have my economist hat on and thinking employers are probably responding rationally here to the overall group, but there's variation within that group. And the people who would make great employees deserve a chance. How do we help employers find them, basically? And so one hypothesis here, and this is what we were tested with Ban the Box, was, well, maybe, you know, we wish employers didn't ask this question. And maybe if we take this question off, then people with a criminal record will get a chance to get their foot in the door, build rapport with the employer, demonstrate they would be a great employee. And then when they can check their background at the end of the hiring process, which Ban the Box still allowed, then they might not care about the criminal record anymore because they've had a chance to talk to this person. So great idea. I think, you know, what someone like me worries about when I hear about a policy like that is when you remove information from a decision, we're not changing anything about the underlying incentives employers are worried about. They were worried about a criminal record for some reason. And now we're telling them they can't ask if someone has a criminal record. Well, then I would expect them to try to guess who has a record and now use the information they can still see, which is, you know, less accurate than the information they had, but use the information they still can see, like race, like education level, like age, to try to guess, especially who has a recent criminal conviction that they might be worried about. And so, you know, this is an empirical question. I have a study looking at the actual rollout of Ban the Box laws across the country to see what happens to employment. There was also a really cool field experiment that some other researchers did, sending out job applications from fictitious applicants before and after Ban the Box went into effect, randomizing race, randomizing whether they had a record. Both of these studies together, and both of them said or showed that when Ban the Box went into effect, you see that employers rely more on race. So racial disparities in hiring go up. And so employers do seem to be statistically discriminating in econ parlance against young Black men in particular. And so what that means is that young Black men who don't have a criminal record now are having trouble getting their foot in the door. They're not getting a callback because employers are guessing that they are more likely than other applicants to have a criminal record. And so we've just broadened the discrimination rather than reducing it. There's been subsequent research showing that it didn't even help. Ban the Box hasn't even helped people with records, which I think we all thought, well, surely you'll see some people with records get the job now, but you've got this big unintended consequence that really matters. But it turns out when you get to the end of the background, the end of the hiring process and do the background check, employers still just don't hire the person. So there's really something about that criminal record that employers are worried about, and removing that information, it turns out, did not address those concerns.
Fascinating. So I want to flip the question, and I'm going to hope I don't get tongue-tied as I try to rephrase this. So dismissing cases for first-time defendants, you thought that wouldn't really matter, but it does work. Is there something that you were like, wow, I, Jennifer Doleac, am passionate that this works, and it doesn't at all? Was that ever something you encountered?
That's a great question. I think, I, like most people, really assumed that on the reentry side, people coming out of prison or who have a criminal record, if we're trying to help them reintegrate, I think anyone who works in this space quickly realizes that that this population has a lot of challenges, right? So they have low education, they maybe don't have much job training, they maybe have been in prison for a while, so any skills they did have atrophied. They're probably dealing with untreated mental illness. They might have a substance use issue. They're just the general problems of poverty, right? This is a low-income population. And so figuring out, like, how do we help this person get on their feet is really challenging. And trying to address any one of those needs feels like just a drop in the bucket. And so most programs in this space tend to provide what people call wraparound services, where they try to address, maybe they started just doing one thing, we'll get you a driver's license or something. And then they realize, like, oh, they also need a ride to work, or they also need education, or they also need therapy, right? And so these services just grow and grow and grow. They often include case managers to help them navigate all this stuff. And so these programs sound great. And I, like most people, I think, would think that that would be really effective, like that we're going to have to do more, like the programs that are more intensive like that will have a bigger impact than programs that are just doing one thing. And it turns out I was totally wrong about that. We were totally wrong. We, the society, are totally wrong about that. So there have been some really nice, really large scale randomized trials now, because a lot of government funding goes into these programs. And so thankfully, the government has run some really nice randomized trials, providing funding to a large number of programs, but conditional on randomizing, you know, who of the clients that are eligible, who gets in, who doesn't, to be able to really test what's the impact, to measure the bang for our buck. And I think the question on everyone's mind was just, well, how big is that bang? Clearly, there's going to be like some benefit, but just how big is it? And is it worth the cost here? And it turns out that those studies have found zero impact, or no statistically significant impact across the board. And if anything, and sometimes it's statistically significant, but usually, if anything, the effect goes the other way. So the people who are in the treatment group actually are more likely to be reincarcerated than people who are in the control group. So it seems like, if anything, these programs are actually making things worse rather than better. And that's definitely surprising to me. I think we still don't fully understand why that is. Feels like there are two potential hypotheses, especially in a context where we do have evidence that those one-off programs, like just giving someone healthcare, for instance, is really effective. And so it's like, okay, well, then the program that includes healthcare and other stuff is not effective. What's going on here? It could be that trying to do everything at once means you're not doing anything well, right? It just gets watered down. But the other possibility that I think I lean more and more toward is the sense that if you're trying to do everything for someone, you're not giving them any space to kind of rack up wins on their own. And you're like subtly communicating that you're the kind of person who like, who can't do anything on your own and you really need a lot of help. And so it might sort of unintentionally reduce people's sense of agency in a way that is really counterproductive. And so being able to just give people a little bit of help, give them healthcare or give them transportation or give them a government ID, and then kind of back up a little bit and give them space to go rack up some wins on their own, that could be more effective. So that's a space where I think the evidence has been really surprising, but is probably still not widely understood.
I think the reason I was interested in having you speak to that pair of questions is we are in a time of like intense polarization where changing your mind on something is like not really
uncommon.
Yes. it's not really popular.
Yeah.
But to me, it sounds like, you know, when I was reading your book and when I have engaged with your work online and that kind of thing, it does feel like there is like a relentless sort of dedication to being like, I'm open to accepting a counterintuitive conclusion. Do you find that true of economics? Is that just a Jennifer Doleac thing? Is that kind of why economics is a useful framework for looking at things like this that may seem totally, you know, irrelevant in a way?
I do think that's pretty, common in economics broadly. And probably is why economists tend to be really useful. I mean, I'm biased, but I think economics tends to be really useful in these policy conversations. I mean, I think I find that in a lot of conversations, you know, the very different prior that I bring to a conversation than others do is that I'm assuming that most things we try are not going to work. And so I have guesses like anyone else about what I think could work. But I also have seen enough things, enough evidence of really great ideas not work that I, you know, it keeps me humble, I guess. And I think most people approach this conversation thinking, well, we know what we need to do. We just don't have the political will to do it. And so most of our good ideas will work. And then any call for research just sounds like we're trying to slow things down, where I'm assuming most things we try aren't going to work. And so the goal should be like, we need the research so that we can fail as fast as possible so we can then move on to the next thing. But yeah, I think, you know, economists, our general framework of how humans, you know, behave and make decisions is that we're all, you know, taking the various costs and benefits in front of us and our own preferences about what goal, you know, what makes us happy. And we're kind of constantly optimizing internally. We're making choices based on the constraints we face and the options available to us to achieve that goal. And so if some policy comes along that changes some costs and benefits, we don't just immediately do whatever the policymaker wanted. We're all just going to like re-optimize and kind of try to get back to as close to that original equilibrium as we can. And so that's why, you know, we generally expect that you're going to see these unintended consequences. You're going to see much smaller impacts than you would anticipate. And that's a very different worldview than, say, lawyers have, which is useful. It's a useful tension in the policy conversation, I think.
I assume the biggest, or not maybe the biggest, but one of the most common pushbacks would be that, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but mm-hmm. that it would be that this approach is almost too like bottom line mentality. Mm. Do you hear that? And what would your response to it be?
I think it gets back to our earlier conversation about, you know, there is a huge values piece to this and right. there's a sense of justice and what people deserve.
Right.
Yeah, it's not my lane. Yeah. I think we obviously need both. I mean, that question about, you know, what are the values of the community more broadly? How do we weight these different things? What are our actual goals to begin with? Do we care most about reducing crime? Do we care most about reducing racial disparities? Do we care most about maximizing health? Like, what is the goal we're trying to reach here? All of that is the job of policymakers and, you know, judges and people in these decision-making roles. And so there are a lot of factors that go into their decisions, but I think especially in the criminal justice space, we've undervalued and underinvested in answering these empirical questions about like, okay, but what actually works? What is the impact of this thing? And so yes, values matter, but the real world impact also matters. And we need both of those inputs to be able to make a decision. Right. And if we only have the values piece of the conversation, we just get into screaming matches, right? Which I find very frustrating. And so having the empirical answers as well, saying like, yeah, that's a great idea. But if your goal is maximizing employment for people with criminal records, Ban the Box is not getting you there. What else can we try? Here are some other options. It's just a crucial part of the policy conversation where I think other fields, other areas of the policy space are just farther ahead of us. Right. Like this is much more common in even the health space, education space to have the kind of data and empirical evidence sure. to bear on the conversations. And so that's, really I and others are really trying to bring this empirical toolkit into the criminal justice space to focus at least, you know, a substantial part of the conversation on ROI. Like, what are we actually getting for all of this money and time and energy that we're spending?
Right, because in the book, you talk about how when you were at, you know, a conference and it was, the idea was presented to you that it was essentially no one was in that space. There were a couple yeah. people, but it was a growing area of interest where a lot not
in
lot,
economics
not, yeah not exactly not a lot of yeah. people had married the two fields yet.
Right. So I got my PhD in 2012, and so that happened to be I got lucky. There's a lot of luck in the world, which is useful. There's I got lucky and came out with my PhD just at a time when there were a few very senior people who had been working in this space. Interestingly, most of them were outside of econ departments. They're in policy schools or they're in law schools, but they're economists. And they were really trying to bring people who were new PhDs together at a conference we'd all done our dissertations on topics related to crime, but maybe thought of ourselves as labor economists or just applied microeconomists who work on lots of things. And they were trying to get us to really focus on this area and stay here, right? Like really go all in on crime, the criminal justice system as an area of focus. And that was really risky for junior economists. Like it took me a little while to really accept that this was going to be my main area. For a while there, I still was like, well, I can work on lots of things. But I just kept coming back to these questions in the public safety area, partly because they're so important, partly because there's just so much room. We know so little. And I mean, there's enough now, you know, over 10 years later to put a book together, but there's still so much we don't know. And there's so much room where the empirical toolkit that economists bring is really useful that it was wound up being a good place for me to build my career. And I think still a great place for researchers to build their careers. But we were pretty late to this party as economists. The sociologists have been working on this for a really long time. Criminologists have been working on it for a really long time. And economists really just got here 10, 15 years ago.
So I know we can't talk about every topic in the book. Other than Ban the Box, one of the things I was really interested in asking you about, because it is, I think, still somewhat of a controversial idea, is the proposal that prisons should be more comfortable and not these depressing places of gloom and doom. I know that, you know, you don't like to comment necessarily on the value. I mean, I think the objection to that is value driven. The idea that okay, well, if you're a rapist or something like that, you don't deserve a nice bed and nice activities and things like that. But can you talk about the real world impacts of making prison a less awful place to be?
Right. So, yeah, you're exactly right that part of the reason we you know, maybe want prisons to be uncomfortable is that values driven. It feels like that's what someone deserves. Right. And there often is also a tension, I find, between, you know, we might say, even if people realize, yes, it would be good, a net positive for society if we invested a lot in like technology and education in prisons, and the communities that the people in prison are coming from are saying, well, we don't have that. Like, you know, wait, I have to go to prison to get those opportunities? That doesn't seem fair, right? And so there is a values and a political dimension to this. But if we're focused just on public safety, right, which is where I can be useful, then I think there's also been a hypothesis that having harsher prison sentences, not just length, but the quality of you know, the experience, if it's really miserable, then that will deter people from committing crime in the future. And it'll deter all of us. Like, we'll all be so, we'll want to, we'll care so much about avoiding ever setting foot in a prison that we will make sure we stay out of trouble. And that's an empirical question, right? Like, do we actually see that happen? Because on the count, you can also argue it the other way, that it can be really traumatizing to be in that environment. And so if that's the case, then that could actually make it more difficult to reintegrate. And so anytime you can argue something both ways, it's like, well, let's go look at the data and see what actually happens. And all of the evidence we have at this point suggests that those harsher prison conditions are actually counterproductive. They increase recidivism rather than reducing it. I think the clearest study of this comes out of Colombia, where they had really terrible prison conditions. And there were all of these, you know, international government reports about how terrible the prisons there were. And so they wound up they had a huge investment in building new prisons, where they had more space for programming, they were less overcrowded, there were more staff per inmate, they were just safer, and the question then was, okay, what's the impact of going to one of those new prisons versus the old prisons? And the new prisons are more expensive, right? They're more staff. It was, you know, you had to build them all, and so it turned out in Colombia, people are sentenced, it's not completely random who goes to what prison, but there's randomness in the process that the researcher was able to harness. And so it turns out that a lot of the time for very similar defendants, it was really just where there was an open bed, right? So it was sort of luck of the draw, which prison they went to. And there was kind of a rotation based on where there was open capacity. And so that provided a natural experiment to see, you know, what's the impact of serving time in the new prison versus the old prison. And this researcher found that serving time in the new prison, if you got lucky or in the new prison instead of the old prison, you were dramatically less likely to reoffend in the future. And he crunched the numbers, and because the question is like, well, but it's expensive to run this new prison. And the numbers he had suggest that it was worth it, right? Just based on even just during the time he was able to study, the return on investment was positive. So that's really interesting. There's also some evidence from Italy that having more open prisons is similarly beneficial, kind of using similar natural experiments. I think this is all, you know, people tend to think of these Scandinavian prisons as being the model of this. They invest in rehabilitation. You're essentially in a dorm room. Maybe you have a TV. You've got, you know, lots of privacy. The prison's in the middle of a big forest. So you can go on, you know, nature walks and stuff. And they have much better outcomes in Norway. But there are lots of differences between Norway and the U.S. And so it's really hard to say it's just because the prison's different. But so these other studies have been really interesting to me because those are closer to our context. And you can imagine then those, you know, being able to translate into the US. Now we are, several states are running randomized trials of more Scandinavian style prison units. And so we'll have some good evidence of this model in the US on both in-prison violence, which is a big problem. And so if we can reduce that, that's good for everybody, but also on recidivism. What's really interesting to me is in those studies so far, in those contexts, we're still waiting on data for the impact of the being incarcerated in one of these Scandinavian-style units on recidivism. But in the meantime, states like Pennsylvania are expanding them because the staff love working in those units so much. And the workforce challenges in prisons in the U.S. are such a huge issue. They're so understaffed that anything they can do to retain and recruit staff is a good thing. And the staff just love that it's much more meaningful to work in these prisons where the focus is rehabilitation rather than just trying to, like, keep everybody from killing each other, right? Like, it's just that's a more meaningful job and a safer job, too.
I always like to ask a few personal questions as well. So you went to, you said you got your PhD from Stanford.
Yes.
In 2012, and then you went to UVA?
My first academic job was at the University of Virginia at the policy school there.
Mm-hmm. And we overlapped for 1 year as I was finishing.
Oh.
I do not believe we ever crossed, or maybe we crossed on the lawn.
Maybe, yes.
Am I allowed to ask what your general politics are, or do you hide that from the world?
You know, I do try to hide it from the world. I'm honestly not even sure anymore. I feel like the political system has, like, changed so much. It's like, am I center right? Am I center left? I don't know. I feel like kind of depending on the issue, I could go either way. But somewhere in there, not on the fringe.
Yeah, not on the fringe. And now, how did you decide to leave academia? And now you're at Arnold Ventures.
Oh, great question. Yeah. So now at Arnold Ventures and so came to AV in 2023. So I... I was always an academic who was really, I was in this to make policy better, right? I wasn't in it to just publish journal articles. Those are a means to an end. I think when I went to graduate school, I never imagined that I would be a professor. I really wanted to go back into the policy space and for various reasons, drank the Kool-Aid, stayed in academia. It turns out it's a good gig, especially as a more junior professor. People tend to think of it as being like, you're super stressed about tenure, but actually it's just like a really, the entire institution is built to help you, to support you in building your expertise. So it's a great time to just become a real expert in something. But what I found over time was that it was harder and harder to stay engaged. I built up this expertise, but then I wanted to use it for something. And that's not what universities are built for. The universities are built for, great, you get tenure, you get promoted to full professor. And now, congratulations, you've checked that box. Now it's your turn to serve on lots of university committees and teach lots of classes so the next generation of scholars can build their expertise. And I was like, no, I want to use this expertise for something. And it was just increasingly difficult to do that from within a university. So I That combined with I was really engaged in my last couple of years in academia in conversations and economics around sexual harassment in the profession, and was just increasingly frustrated by how little the profession was going to change and how little the institutions were taking it seriously. So I think just the combination of waking up every day really cynical about the institution I worked for, combined with, you know, I really want to be out there using my expertise for something in the policy space, and that's harder and harder to do every day, I realized I needed to leave. And so I was trying to figure out what I was going to do next. And AV happened to be looking for someone to run their criminal justice program. And they reached out, really, the stars just aligned. It was the perfect timing. I wouldn't have been open to the conversation 3 months earlier, but then I was. And it turns out it's a really fun job. So I'm learning a lot about how to, you know, turn research into policy, into impact on the ground. And I wake up optimistic every day because there's so much great work happening, especially at the state level. State lawmakers have to balance their budget and they, you know, they typically don't have a staff. They're part-time. They just need help figuring out, you know, what works. And so I feel really, really useful, which is great.
If you had to describe your economic views in just a few, how would you describe them? Are you a free marketeer? Or are you somewhere?
I think I'm a pretty mainstream economist. Okay. I think like most economists, I believe strongly in the power of market forces, but I would not call myself a libertarian.
Okay. You know what I'm getting at. I was just curious.
Yeah. I mean,
a boy can
do. Yeah.
It's
just, you know, there's a role for government,
right,
and market. There are a lot of market failures out there, and we need to be. I think of myself very much as a technocrat. Actually, it's okay. I think that government can do a lot of good, and it can also, but it can also do a lot of harm if you don't get it right. And so, I really care about the data.
We can debate that over a martini. And here, Jennifer Doleac is summoned to the White House and given a magic wand to change one thing in our current system. What does she do?
I would embed quasi-experiments or actual randomized trials into all federal funding, especially obviously in criminal justice system is the one I care about the most, but the federal government actually has most policy happens at the state level, but the way that the federal government, the role that the federal government plays is primarily through funding streams. And right now we give out lots of grants based on what we think sounds, you know, is good at the state level, but we don't learn from that nearly as much as we could. And then we have such an amazing, like our federalist system, our decentralized system is a challenge if we know what we need to do when we want to scale it. But that is not where we are. We do not know what we need to do in most cases. We need everybody trying different things. All 12,000 different police departments be trying different things, all the states be trying different things, and then figure out what works so we can scale those things or that other jurisdictions can learn from each other. And right now we're giving it all this money. And maybe maybe there's something in there requiring $100K goes to an evaluation at the end, but then you get some mediocre report from some consulting firm that is not what I mean by research. And so if we could actually say you can have this money, but you have to embed a staggered rollout, or you have to actually implement it as a pilot with randomization, we would learn so much so fast. So if I had a magic wand, that's what I'd do.
An underrated point, bang for the buck on taxpayer dollars. Jennifer Doleac, thank you so much for talking to Reason. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Billy.